You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now, a shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
On the program today, a question. How are you feeling? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland, I'm Rima Reis in for Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, August 14th. Good to have you with us. There is a thing, a thesis, if you will, that we say all the time on this show, and that is consumer spending, which makes up about two-thirds of U.S. GDP, it drives this economy. So again, how are you feeling? Because our willingness to keep on spending robustly, despite inflation, despite soaring interest rates, it is almost single-handedly keeping this economy out of a recession. Tomorrow, with July retail sales, we'll get a good sense if we consumers are still doing our part. Because on one hand, the New York Fed reports that U.S. households feel their finances have improved from a year ago. But at the same time, we've got data that show Americans are racking up more and more credit card debt. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports on the economic conundrum that is the U.S. consumer.
So what's keeping U.S. consumers spending month after month, even as inflation and rising interest rates eat away at family finances? One economic driver, says Mark Hamrick at Bankrate.
There was excess savings accumulated during the pandemic, and that has not gone away.
Many upper-income folks still have money left over to go on trips and buy new cars. Many lower- and middle-income Americans have spent down savings to pay bills, but they're at least still working, says Hamrick.
And now we're actually seeing wages at or above the pace of inflation.
And what folks can't afford, they're borrowing for. Hamrick cites a recent Bankrate survey that found about half of Americans now carry a credit card balance month to month. That's up nearly 10% since 2021. And it's risky because interest rates are high and balances keep going up.
We're a sort of kick-the-can economy.
You know, spend now, pay later. And what's behind that? Consumer psychologist Ayelet Fishback at the University of Chicago has some ideas.
People don't realize how much credit card debts are going to be a burden. And we see that people are struggling to think long-term.
She thinks this could be because of the pandemic or domestic politics, geopolitical turmoil, climate change. Whatever the cause, it's leading to an attitude of
enjoy life now because the future is too scary, it's too unpredictable.
Another possibility, we're actually getting used to all this hardship and unpredictability, says Regan Leggett, who tracks global consumer behavior at NIQ.
Look at the last 2 to 3 years and feel a bit more confident because they've survived. You know, a lot of consumers experience either job loss or income loss, but now they're starting to feel a bit more on track.
And that means spending, even if it's money you don't have right now, can feel all right. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was a good day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Safe to say, over the last few years, there's been a good amount of uncertainty in the stock market. Some pretty wild swings, thanks, of course, to the pandemic, the supply chain issues over the last couple of years, and all the ups and downs in big tech. Meanwhile, a whole new generation of younger investors, or I should say younger potential investors, they've been on the sidelines, watching, taking notes. We asked Marketplace's Kristen Schwab to give us a sense of how Gen Z and millennials are feeling about the market. Christopher Davenport started his freshman year at the University of Michigan in 2020, when the pandemic was very much pandemicking.
There were no social things going on. You could barely really get out of your dorm. All the classes were virtual.
So he joined Michigan Interactive Investments, a club on campus. The group learns about investing by managing a small portfolio, originally funded by alumni. Davenport is now the club's president. He says, though most members are business students like himself, the pool is diversifying.
You hear all about the Wall Street bets and people talking about crypto online, people going on different Discord chats and whatnot. It's definitely gotten investing generally to a wider demographic,
including some young people who found themselves with a little extra time and money. Dan Egan, director of behavioral finance and investing at Betterment, an automated investment advisor, says during the pandemic,
we definitely saw a large number of deposits during the appropriate time periods where people are saying, this is because I got a stimulus check that I didn't really need.
Meanwhile, it's become easier to invest than ever. Terrence O'Dean, a finance professor at UC Berkeley, says there's app-based and commission-free trading.
And now you can actually buy fractional shares, buy not only less than 100 shares, you can buy less than one share.
Which he says has increased access for people with less money. A Federal Reserve survey from 2019 says about half of Americans invest. How much that has changed? O'Dean says, we don't know. Surveys of millennial and Gen Z interest in investing have mixed results. O'Dean says that's partly because
what you live through affects how you view the market.
Studies show young people's opinions on investing are especially correlated to market returns. So how's Davenport in Michigan doing with his personal investments?
I didn't have that much money to begin with, and I still don't really have that much.
But hey, he's learning. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Back in early July, heavy rains across the Northeast led to devastating floods, especially in Vermont. In some places, damage was fairly minimal, thanks in part to property buyouts that started 12 years ago after a flood caused by Tropical Storm Irene. About 170 homes have been purchased and demolished in Vermont since then. Now, after the July floods, dozens more may be needed. But as those in Vermont have learned over the last decade, the process of buyouts is rarely easy or efficient. Marketplace's Henry Epp explains.
Along the Dog River in Northfield, Vermont, you'll find a small park with a wooden pavilion and a few picnic tables and benches across a large open lawn.
And then as you get closer to the river, there's a big meadow area with a big walking path that loops around. And right along the river, there is a buffer of trees and shrubs.
That's Michelle Braun, the executive director of a nonprofit that works on river protection in Vermont. She's also the former land use planner for Northfield, a town of less than 6,000 people. It's hard to tell at first, but as we look around Dog River Park, the signs of flooding that hit this area in early July become apparent. Some small trees are bent over and filled with dead leaves and sticks that were carried by the floodwaters. You can see signs that water spilled onto the lawn, too.
I describe it as sediment dropped by the river. It looks like a lawn with muddy areas.
On July 10th, Braun says, floodwaters covered this park and the adjacent street and spilled into the basements of some nearby homes. But that was it, because this was not a park the last time major flooding hit in 2011. It was a neighborhood of seven homes.
For the seven houses that we no longer see in the park where we're sitting, they would have been flooded in this most recent flood.
But the town bought out all those homes after Tropical Storm Irene in 2011, a move that not everyone liked. The main concern, that demolishing homes would reduce Northfield's property tax rolls, also known as its grand list.
My main argument was that it was the flood that had hit the grand list, not the buyouts. The purpose of the buyouts is to save the community money in the long run, to prevent these massive losses from happening again in the future.
Ultimately, town leaders agreed, and in total, Braun arranged 18 buyouts around Northfield. Some took up to 4 years to complete. Other buyouts in Vermont took as long as a decade. One way that process could be sped up, if risk areas are mapped by planners and buyouts are discussed with homeowners before a disaster strikes, says A.R. Siders, an assistant professor at the University of Delaware who studied buyout programs.
You don't want the first time someone ever hears about a buyout, you don't want it to be when they're standing in 3 feet of mud, because at that moment, they are also emotionally overwhelmed. They might be financially overwhelmed, and you don't want them to be making that big decision in that emotional moment.
Vermont and other states and municipalities have started to do this by setting up ongoing buyout programs. In the last 2 years, the state legislature directed nearly $20 million in federal pandemic relief funds to its buyout program. The idea, says Stephanie Smith, the state's hazard mitigation officer, is to be more proactive.
In a perfect world, the program is designed in a way where it's intended to be forward-thinking, long-term risk reduction, so that we're fixing things before they go wrong.
But in reality,
people are most interested in it when things have gone wrong.
Like right now, with homes and businesses around the state still reeling from the July flooding. Smith says the state is just beginning the process of offering buyouts. Already, she says, about 120 homeowners have expressed interest in selling. Kevin Geiger is a director with the Local Planning Commission who worked on buyouts after Tropical Storm Irene. He says as long and challenging as that process was, it paid off.
Well over 100 households did not lose basically all of their money in their house. And nobody had to go rescue them. Nobody had knocked on their door. They didn't have to lose everything. None of that trauma happened again to them or to the next person.
The work now is to find ways to do buyouts faster before the next flood hits. In Northfield, Vermont, I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I don't know if you've ever heard of the saying where if you love something, you can do it for free.
If only free could pay the bills. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones ticked up 26 points to finish essentially flat at 35,307. The Nasdaq increased 143 points, 1%, to close at 13,788. And the S&P 500 rose 25 points, 0.6%, to end at 4489. We heard earlier from Mitchell about the so far resilient U.S. consumer, so let's take a look at some of the stores where they're spending. Target marked down 1.25%, Walmart lost 0.75%, and Amazon picked up 1.5%. Let's also check on some big banks while we're at it. JP Morgan Chase climbed 0.2%, Bank of America took back 1.1%, and Capital One Financial contracted by 1.1%. Bonds fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.19%. You're listening to Marketplace.
You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. It's been about a year since lawmakers created the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. That's the $27 billion pot of money passed through the Inflation Reduction Act. The idea is that it'll help finance clean energy projects. And as you can imagine, there's competition among lenders to win some of that money. Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall checked on how that process is going.
With fall grant application deadlines just around the corner, it's all hands on deck for nonprofit lenders bidding to distribute billions of government dollars.
The clock is ticking. There's definitely no vacation time this summer for all of us.
Brian Garcia is with the Connecticut Green Bank, which is applying for funds that would finance projects to help New Englanders deal with the consequences of severe weather.
We want to see clean energy, energy efficiency, battery storage.
He says the money will be used to finance projects in low-income communities the market leaves behind. Nicole Elam is with the National Bankers Association, a trade group of minority-owned financial institutions.
When I think about my members, they serve communities that are 77% minority, that are two times more likely to be denied for a small business loan by large institutions, even if they have the exact same credit profile.
Her group is part of a coalition of lenders that created the Justice Climate Fund to apply for money as one entity and then distribute it to different credit unions and other financial institutions across the country.
Because you want to be able to show that you've got national impact.
Whitney Mann with clean energy think tank RMI says grants will help community lenders finance anything from home heat pumps to boosting EV infrastructure.
If you think about if there's not an EV charger that's available for public use, then you're not going to be interested in EV unless you own a home with an area where you can charge your EV.
While $27 billion is clearly not enough to meet greenhouse gas emissions targets, Adam Kent with the National Resources Defense Council says
it is a significant and unprecedented down payment.
He says funding is not only going to attract additional private sector capital, but it will also be recycled over time.
They make an EV loan, that loan gets repaid. And that allows the credit union to make another EV loan.
Kent says the money could start flowing into actual projects by late next year. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Now, a story about recycling. A lot of people in the U.S. live in places where they can just dump all their paper, glass, aluminum, and plastic recyclables in one bin. It's also known as single-stream recycling. Convenient, but also tough for the recycling plant, and less valuable than it used to be when it was easier to sell recyclables to other countries. So what can those plants process these days? KCRW reporter Kaylee Wells went to one in Los Angeles to find out.
The starting pile of recyclable trash at this plant is large enough to hide four of the giant semi-trucks offloading their hauls. This is what the trucks bring in from about 5 million people in a day.
Some people call it the Amazon effect, but you see a lot of cardboard.
Mark Grady is the Southern California Recycling Director for Waste Management, now known as WM. It's the largest waste hauler in the country. He says the stuff in this pile first gets shuttled onto a conveyor belt upward to a series of giant spiraling corkscrews.
What that does is big material stays on the top, little material falls through.
Anything big or flat, like cardboard, floats over the top. Anything smaller than about a foot falls through and heads for the pre-sort room, says the recycling plant's manager, Kevin Vaughn.
The sorters are trying to capture as much contamination out of the stream as possible.
Half a dozen people in masks are watching the mostly cardboard fly by them, occasionally pulling out pieces of metal to be sorted somewhere else or unrecyclable plastics to send to the landfill. They're pulling it off the line and dropping it into one of the trash chutes along the sides of the belt. The paper and plastic streams each head toward its own set of robotic arms. Those arms look for materials that don't belong and suck them up, kind of like carnival claws searching for stuffed animals. Except Grady says each one can grab as many as 1,000 pieces per minute.
It may say, hey, it's not right for this bunker where we're going to make this material, but it goes into a conveyor under us that goes back and goes through another opportunity to get picked.
In a quiet office right next to the Loud recycling plant, WM Southern California President Mike Hammer explains the system is imperfect. They can recycle all but about a quarter of the stuff that comes through the facility every day.
The vast majority of that is material that didn't belong there in the first place.
Some frequent offenders? Bowling balls and garden hoses. But then there's recyclable stuff that the machinery just can't catch. Perhaps the greatest headache of all, plastic bags, even recyclable ones.
They're problematic because of the technological aspects of it, where they wrap and they blow and they get all over.
Everything that does make it gets smushed together into giant cubes. Think hay bales, but much larger. Hammer says that is the facility's final sellable product.
The aluminum cans over here, maybe 1% of the waste stream.
Those might get bought by beer companies making new cans.
The water bottles are probably, I think, two or three times more by volume than the aluminum cans.
They're still useful for companies that make eco-friendly toys or clothes or carpet or other things that can use recycled plastic, but that might be their last reincarnation.
The biggest components certainly are the cardboard and the paper.
Those frequently hitch a ride on a boat to China that will then often return to bring us new cardboard boxes filled with the stuff we're buying online. So there's still a lot of recycling going on, and yet the EPA says nationwide only about 32% of waste is recycled or composted. And the biggest reason? Plastics.
Currently, very little of the plastic that consumers buy is recyclable.
Rachel Mocky-Wagner is the director of California's recycling department, CalRecycle.
That is the unfortunate truth of where we are today, and we're producing more and more plastic in our economy every year.
She says so many residents come to her confused about what they can add to their recycling bin.
But doing us one better would be never creating that plastic in the first place. So reduction of plastic bags is absolutely what we need to be doing. We need to reduce overall production of plastic in the market, period.
She says some places like California are trying to move that needle with new laws and waste diversion goals. But in the meantime, there's a better answer than recycling the takeout container or the plastic bottle, she says. Reduce production of plastics overall. In Los Angeles, I'm Kaylee Wells for Marketplace.
We heard from Mitchell at the top of the show about consumer habits and our ongoing penchant for spending. And you know, among all that stuff we're buying, a good chunk of it is, of course, on clothing. This year, the global apparel market is expected to rake in more than $1.7 trillion in revenue. But what good are all those clothes if you're not sure how to wear them? And that brings us to the latest installment of our series, My Economy.
Hey, it's Valencia Holland. I'm the CEO and founder of The Style Educator. I'm coming to you from Atlanta, Georgia. I got my start as a stylist back in the early 2000s. I was the go-to girl for friends and family who wanted advice on what to wear. Whenever it was like their birthdays or special occasions, my phone would start going off with text messages about, hey, I'm heading here. What do you think I should wear? And then fast forward around 2010 or 11, I learned people did this professionally. People got paid for this. And then I just began to progress from there as far as investing in myself and learning more about the field, because just because you know how to do something naturally doesn't mean that there isn't a business side to it. When it came down to pricing, that's definitely been an evolution. I was afraid to kind of really charge. That was one of the areas that I really had to work on. I don't know if you've ever heard of the saying where if you love something, you can do it for free, because that's how I felt about it. But I had to switch my mindset to say, yes, you love it, but this is your livelihood. It became a thing of people are going to pay for what they really want. Whenever you think of the fashion industry, you think of brands. Those high-end brands, they're not focused on who cannot afford their products. They know that there are people that want the product. So it's education, it's experience, it's the result that people will pay for. When I think about a success story for me, it will always be my first client. When it comes to your family and friends, you automatically have a relationship with them. That person didn't grow up with me. That person hadn't had a chance to hear from a word of mouth of, oh, hey, just text V. She'll tell you what to wear, right? This person saw what I put out and it was enough for them to trust me. Then to see their shoulders rise, to see they're radiant, they're glowing, they're smiling, that will always mean a lot to me for that person to trust me with their image and with their body. And for that, I will forever be grateful.
Valencia Holland out in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, we can't do this series without you, so let us know what's going on in your economy by sending us a message over at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today. Now, we started the show talking about consumer spending, so thought I'd share another data point I came across in a CNBC article. It is about how more Americans are choosing to travel abroad this summer instead of domestically. International airfare is up 10% from last year, whereas domestic round trips are down 11%. That means hotels abroad are also getting pricier. Room rates for Europe hotels are up 14% from last year. Now, this is not great news for airlines that mostly operate in the U.S., or for their investors, for that matter. But some airlines like Delta and United are trying to capitalize on the moment, ramping up their international services to meet the demand of eager American travelers. All right, we got to get out of here. But first, your moment of economic context. Artificial intelligence is coming for your dating life. There's news out from Insider today about how the dating app Hinge, it is looking for a VP to oversee its AI strategy. Why do you need AI for your love life, you ask? Well, the company's plan is to roll out AI features that would help with user safety, with its recommendation engine, and dealing with bad actors or algorithms. Meanwhile, its parent company, Match Group, it is currently developing tools like AI-enabled photo selection, a thing that would scan your photo albums and help you pick the best pictures for your profile. So you can find everlasting love and, you know, not bother your friends in the process. Our daily production team includes Livy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Sophia Terenzio. And I'm Rima Jerez. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM. Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.